Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN 720. We're here with Rob Sevier, co-founder of the Numero Group. And it's just a warm, warm reissue you guys have done, sitting in the park.
Thanks, Dave.
Part of the Eccentric Soul series. First of all, tell us what Numero Group is.
So we're a record label that specializes in archival recordings. We've been around almost 14 years now. We're located here in Chicago, and we, you know, have a special place in our heart for Chicago music of all kinds. And, you know, our focus is music from the 50s through the 80s, but we branch out a little bit into the 90s.
And I came into your history a little bit with the soul music and the R&B.
Right.
I mean, some of the Syl Johnson stuff. And
yeah, we've done a lot of Chicago soul. We've got a lot of Chicago soul recordings in our catalog. Some were never released before. Some were under-released. You know, some were, you know, came and went without notice whenever they, you know, were first pressed to vinyl.
Yeah, yeah. So now the Sitting in the Park series with... it's a tribute.
It's a tribute. It is consistent with what we do with our Eccentric Soul compilation series, which is we tell the story of somebody who is making soul music happen, sort of against significant odds. And this is a different kind of story, but it actually mirrors the stories of a lot of the people that were behind the, you know, Eccentric Soul recordings from the 60s and 70s. You know, the radio was very significant as far as the way that they got the word out, and that, you know, that was the medium by which a lot of these label owners reached people. And that was why they were significant in their communities. That's why artists came to them to work with them. And Bob Abrahamian, who was the host of the Sitting in the Park radio show on WHBK, was no different. He was just doing it today.
And did you cross paths with him? Did you know him? Tell us about...
Did
he help you with some of your other projects?
Bob worked on a lot of projects. Bob was a very tireless, literally tireless, in the sense that he was often insomniac, pursuer of soul recordings from the 60s and 70s, and the groups that recorded them, and the people that ran the labels and the songwriters. He would, you know, and he amassed a massive collection of recordings. And his long running project was to interview Chicago soul groups on his Sitting in the Park radio show. And so this is a tribute to both his efforts and his life, by collecting the groups that he interviewed and some of the songs that he brought to light on his radio show.
And you have transcriptions of the interviews.
Correct.
And then you wrote the liner notes, which are very warm.
Yes.
Very warm and very detailed.
You know, Bob was a significant and complex and rich character.
You say, I'm just quoting from your liner notes, he passed away in 2014.
Correct.
He left behind 35,000. Was it just unique
least.
Singles?
Yeah.
Just singles?
He was, Chicago soul was, soul music was by and large a singles culture. You know, LPs were often in this, you know, certainly in the 60s, LPs generally were collections of singles. You know, a group had enough singles and then they'd get an LP. So really, most groups, it's a culture of singles, you know. In the 70s, it begins to be a little more album-oriented a little bit, but really most groups recorded singles.
And he would play these on his show. I'm interested in his connection. I mean, doing radio here, but how did the word get out on his show, and how did how did people respond, especially other, you know, singers and other artists, as the word got out about him?
Well, it was a pretty slow process. The amazing thing is that he did this radio show for 13 years, and he never played really the same song twice. other than the fact that he would occasionally take requests, you know, and those requests tended to be like a Billy Stewart song or something that was popular locally. But he, I mean, that's a staggering feat to think about. He did a weekly show, and he never, you know, that he was acquiring records at such a rate, and the amount of work that goes into that is not insignificant. You're acquiring enough records, you're listening to enough records to make sure that they actually fit the criteria of your radio show, and you're getting them organized and cleaned and ready to play on air. You know, I mean, it took, you know, 20 hours a week or something to do this radio show. You know, and that not every week, but often.
That's more time than we spend.
Right.
Was Rick Wojcik? I mean, I was over there today at Dusty Groove. Was he a precursor to this? I mean, again, in your notes, Rick was doing a show, Dusty Groove, one of our sponsors. He was doing the Dusty's Party, and then he kind of left in '96.
And then JP Chill. I mean, both the rap show that JP Chill did and the Dusty's show that Rick did. Both of those were precursors to what Bob was doing. Now, Bob did his own thing, of course, but he was on those shows before he had his own show. And that, of course, is the politics of community radio. You have to kind of pay your dues. And so, you know, when he got the chance to do his own, by the time he figured out to do what he wanted to do for his own show, it was focused on these group harmony singles that he was collecting.
We're going to play a couple tracks in a little bit from this, but how did he find, I mean, was there, I may be romanticizing it, but was there a lot of record digging on the South Side then? I know in later years he probably, you say in your liner notes, he was, working the internet at all odd hours and stuff.
He did it all at the same time.
Did he really?
Oh, yeah. Well, he had relationships with Junkers. He was going to flea markets. Yeah. I went with him often on these expeditions, you know, for many years. I mean, of course it slowed down. It became an inefficient way to try and find records to get them direct. Because if, you know, when you think about all the people that know about eBay and are just putting find a record, put it on eBay, whatever it is, it's actually much more efficient and intelligent to just go to eBay. And when you think about all the money you put into gas just driving from his place in Logan Square to the South Side, you're actually, you know, if you're spending $10 on a record, you're saving money on eBay, you know.
Well, give me an example of how that worked. I didn't know that. So you went with him. What was that like? I mean, give me the.
Well, I mean, if you were a record collector, if you are trying to, of any significance, you have to look for records you have to be diverse in your pursuits. You can't only pursue one. You have to begin, you know, we were doing similar kinds of things. We were getting in touch with artists and talking to them about their music and finding leads to, you know, we'd go visit people like Lucky Cordell, you know, rest in peace. And he was selling off his record collection for years. And when we went and visited him, you know, probably 10, 15, 20 people had looked at his records, but they weren't looking for the types of things we were looking for. And we got amazing records from him. He was trying to liquidate, you know, he had Lucky Cordell had probably 60,000-70,000 records just from being in a significant, important DJ on WVON all those years. He was just serviced these records. So, you know, and the people that looked at his records before were mostly British collectors who were pretty conservative about their tastes in soul music. So we were getting very strange stuff. We were getting Phil Curran singles and we were getting, you know, incredible gospel singles that no one had paid any attention to. And even the books actually that we got from him, because he had, you know, people would, Lucky was interesting in that he would read poetry on air. He would read articles in poetry on air. He had in love letters. I mean, you know, his style was very unique, Lucky's was, and so the books that he had were fascinating. I mean, he had a lot of books that represented Afrocentric culture in the 50s and 60s that he was just like getting rid, you know, he just wanted to liquidate all this stuff. So these are the types of people that we would pay visits to, and you know, not everyone wants to keep all their records. Most people want to get rid of them, you know.
Listeners of the show, the regular listeners, will know our love of soul music. I mean, we had Otis Clay in the studio. We had Mitty Collier in the studio. I love soul music. I've talked to you guys at Numero Group about my love of beach music and how much of beach music in the Carolinas is rooted in Chicago soul. But Bob suffered, and I only talked to Bob a couple times, maybe for fact-checking when I was doing a story for the Sun-Times. Bob was meticulous and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But he suffered from depression, and I don't know if I'm making a stretch here, but I just find soul music just so liberating and just so inspiring. Did that resonate at all with him? Was that why he loved it so much? I mean, only like vocal groups, or am I just those two things don't relate?
I wouldn't make that connection, yeah, just because it. I think that collecting for him, I mean, his passion for the music was impressive, but you know, he was. The collecting aspect of it served sort of a need of, you know, of the meticulousness was well served by this pursuit. And so, you know, the two went hand in hand. The sort of filling the numbers of a discography is a passion that's a little bit independent from the music. But of course, he loved the music and had great taste in the music. But you know, what I think he was really looking for in his life was a significant pursuit. Because the fact of the matter is, he liked all kinds of music. It wasn't just soul music. You know, I mean, it was fascinating to look at his rock collection and, like, see, like, you know, New Zealand psych records from the, you know, from the 80s and 90s, like Flying Nun titles and, like, you know, Japanese noise. And, like, you know, he really loved all kinds of music. He just happened to, he recognized how significant the work was. To, you know, and it, with Group Harmony Soul, and that's why he pursued that.
Okay, we're going to take a break here. We're going to come back, and we're going to play a little bit of a couple tracks from this. I want you to maybe highlight some stuff on here
sure.
So that we won't play. So don't go away. This is fascinating stuff on Nocturnal Journal. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal, and that's Try It, You'll Like It by Master Plan, Inc. Man, you got to come back, because I could just talk about this stuff all night. Tell us about that track. I mean, I know there's a little Cabrini Green, Curtis Mayfield stuff going on there, but that's on the compilation.
Well, this track is interesting for a variety of reasons. One, Bob and I think, originally found the Master Plan record together. We were visiting a guy who was in a different soul group called the Playboys. And he was friends with Doug Shorts. So we got in touch with Doug Shorts. A couple other people got in touch with Doug Shorts as well, including a friend of ours who kind of accidentally got in. There's a whole series of events that I'm going to have to just truncate, because what ends up happening is Doug, you know, we get to be friends with him and a community of record collectors, Andrew Brearley being one of them, who later puts out some of his records. Gets real deep with Doug, and Doug finally finds these cassettes of some songs, including that Try It, You'll Like It song. Uh-huh. And it's totally lo-fi. It's a dub of a dub of a dub. We can tell it's a great song, but there's no way that it wasn't really usable as it was. And such a good song. But so we actually end up, we got into some master tapes through kind of a bizarre series of events that allowed us to get these master tapes from a guy who had stolen them from Ed Cody, who had a studio down here on Wabash and had kept them for many years. And he died, and his widow brought the tapes to a guy who had a record store who ended up calling us. We end up getting into it, and one of the tapes that we happen to find in this brace of master tapes is the Doug Shorts Try It, You'll Like It, which we'd been, you know, we knew was a great song, and it was just like just out of reach. And in those master tapes, we found a bunch of odd stuff like that. And there are so many things. There's another track on this compilation as well that was, you know, Bob had the only copy of the record, and we visited the guy, Earl Wiley, who actually released the record. It's a group on there called Ahead of Your Time. Uh-huh. We visited Earl Wiley, and he said, actually, you know, this version was stolen from me. I went and recorded with Ed Cody, and the next thing I knew, and you know, so we were saying, hey, this story is apocryphal at best. You know, it's a nice story, but we end up finding those tapes that he was telling us about in these Ed Cody tapes as well. So this is a big discovery. You know, it's towards the end of Bob's life, it was a big discovery where we kind of wrap up a bunch of stories that we'd been working on for years in this, like, discovery of these masters.
We're getting calls, and so we want to, before we let you go, give the website and how people can find it. It's just a fascinating story, how people can find it.
Numerogroup.com, NumeroGroup.com. And we're at 2533 South Troy. On the south side.
A couple things about Bob. The depression became paralyzing for him.
Yes. Well, yeah, he went on disability from work. And you know, I mean, he had he was insomniac. He had, you know, and sometimes I would be too. And so we'd get into exchanges at like 4 or 5 in the morning about soul records. It was not uncommon. But he, you know, it was part of, a series of problems that he really had difficulty with. And really couldn't shake.
And he was 35? How old was he when he
was 35 when he ended
his
life.
And it was a suicide.
Yeah. It was, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. What happened to his collection?
It's still intact. His sister is the caretaker of it, and she's been working for the last few years to find a home for it to remain intact.
That would be a great thing, wouldn't it?
It will be. It will be. Yeah.
When you do other projects, do you refer to it at Numero Group? I mean, did he leave written stuff behind, too, that...
You know, the main documents are the radio interviews and which are all archived and are on his website, which is sittinginthepark.com.
Mm-hmm.
So you can listen to all the interviews in full form. They're not at a really high bit rate, so the sound isn't amazing, but they're great documents. That's the main work that he left behind, and a significant archives of photos of Chicago soul groups.
Wow. Well, you guys got to come back. Just talk about some of your other. I know we're going to do some of that country stuff you've done. I mean, you guys, it's really, what you're doing is really, 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 really great. All right, we're going to sign off. I want you to introduce this track. This is what he played all the time.
Yeah,
tell us about Southside.
This is kind of his anthem. This is kind of our anthem. It's Southside Chicago by Otis Brown. We love Otis Brown. We love this song, and it's really meaningful.
Thank you, Rob.
From the south side of Chicago, yeah. And I wanna know what they don't know. This must be my happy day. Yeah. Everything, girl, is going. Southside Chicago, girl, you know it's a place. I can hear it in the morning, yeah. Hear it in the evening.
Oh, listen to the horn, baby. Sounds so.
Journal. We're here with our friend John Lyon. Where are you at, Johnny?
I'm in beautiful Ocean Grove, New Jersey, right on the shore. Jersey Shore, that's me.
Yeah, you're one of my musical heroes. I've been seeing you guys since, I think you and I have talked before, Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes, since that Chicago Reader Party, like in 1977. I forget, it was some restaurant on the south side of Chicago.
That's right, with Junior Wells, yeah.
Right.
That was great.
Yeah, so just a huge fan of the band and stuff. What have you been up to? I saw you in St. Charles on the heels of the Soul Time record. Tell us about the new record, and you're going to be at House of Blues on August 6th.
Yeah, well, we made a record, and it's called Soul Time, and it is a hearkening back to a lot of the soul stylings of, the late 60s, early 70s. I happened to be walking through a liquor store. You know, it's hard to imagine. And it was attached to a big shopping market, and people had their carts and their kids and the things and all. And Superfly by Curtis Mayfield came on, and everybody started bopping and moving. And I thought, I got to make a record that makes people do that. And so that became kind of the epiphany that led to the record.
we're gonna play a couple tracks, and I certainly heard the Curtis Mayfield influence. We've had actually his wife on our show. I'm looking for a good time. I mean, you hear that riff and stuff. Tell me how some of that played into that one particular song. We'll play that in a little bit.
Well, it's just, you know, once you hear the certain way rhythms and of course horn riffs, I've got a whole backlog of horn riffs that I steal. But you just that part, that type of music is really infused in me. That was a great time to be young and in bands and playing all kinds of stuff like the Isley Brothers and Bobby Womack, but it's traditional R&B too, Sam and Dave and Otis Redding. And we just loved that stuff. And people would come and dance, and that's how we made a living back then. When we started making our own records, we had a little bit more rock and roll element to the original material, but a lot of soul, a lot of R&B and blues. And it's just a mix-up of that stuff. But this album is much more soul, 60s, 70s soul-oriented. And it works great live, too. People really get off on it. It's just wonderful to see everybody dancing and singing. You know, it's a great job.
Tell me about the current band. Who will you be bringing to House of Blues?
Three horns, guitar, bass, drums, and keyboards. And they've been with me, they're the guys on the album. They've been with me for a number of years, and it's probably the best band I've ever had. Everybody's really enjoying playing, but they're also great musicians. They're great soloists. So anytime I want to step back and let them solo, I know anybody can do it, including the drummer and the bass player. So, yeah, we don't do a lot of drum solos and bass solos, but occasionally it might happen.
John Isley, saxophone, is he still with you?
Yes, John Isley is with us, and he'll be out there too. He's great, great showman, but a great player too. And we're in the midst of making another record. John Isley and I are collaborating on a record. I won't tell you the details, but it's more jazz-oriented because, like all horn players, they are deep into jazz too. You know, just keeping busy and trying to create music and try different things.
Does he play with Diana Ross when he's not with you?
Yes, he has played with Diana Ross a number of times. All of the guys go out and play with people. My bass player, John Conte, plays with a big German pop rock star when he's in the US after a couple of months in the fall. And I've got subs for all of them, so that's cool with me. If they can make some money, that's great. And I must say that Jeff Kazee and John Conte, two of my players, just played the Republican National Convention with G.E. Smith. So
Really?
Was quite a trip.
Really? Really?
Yeah.
And now, what people may not know, I mean, one time you and I were talking, tell us about your mom and dad and Minnie Mae. I mean, you said that, I remember as you told me one time, I think she was like Wynonna Harris. What I'm getting at with that is tell me about music around the house, and you thought everybody was listening to Wynonna Harris and stuff. So tell me about the influence of rhythm and blues and soul when you were growing up in New Jersey.
I was one of the very fortunate kids. My parents loved music, and they had great taste in music. They listened to everything from Duke Ellington and Count Basie to Wynonna Harris and Joe Turner, Ray Charles, T-Bone Walker. So it was a lot of blues, a lot of river blues, and a lot of really up-tempo jazz. And, you know, I would come home, and they would come home from work. They both worked during the day. And I'd come home from school, and they'd be there, having a beer and listening to music and making dinner. And it just was a lively household. They read a lot. I learned to read from them. I learned the joy of reading from them. But also the music they listened to was never background music. It was always something to get the juices flowing. And that's a real legacy that I've inherited from them. I just love getting people's juices flowing.
One thing about you is, like, I ran into you a few years ago at the Clarence Clemens tribute in Norfolk, Virginia, and you were up early.
Uh-huh.
I was in the lobby, and you had your first one great thing is you had like the more. It was a Saturday. You had like the Saturday newspapers with you, so that was cool. You still read the printed newspapers, but you were going out. You were going out to flea markets, and you were going to go look for records. And then even when I saw you in St. Charles earlier this year, you talked about, I mean, you're really into landscape. You must get up and, like, do you explore the city? You were talking about the Arcata Theater and the Fox River. And, I mean, when you go to a town, do you walk around and check things out and find record stores and flea markets and stuff like that? You get a feel?
I have enough time. Yeah, a lot of times it's you know, you pull into town at 10, 11 o'clock in the morning, and you've got sound check at 5, and you probably need to catch up on some sleep. But if I, in a new town, definitely. We just played a couple of places in Germany that we had never played, and we played a lot of towns in Germany. And you do, you get out and walk around and see what's going on and talk to people. But I'll do that in all the American cities, especially the smaller ones, to go to the thrift stores, junk stores, as we really call them. And, you know, anything like that, the antique malls, just to look for old vinyl, old 45s and 78s and albums. And it gets you out into the city. You meet people. You talk about what's going on in the city. It's just a great way to find out what's going on in the world, you know, what people think.
Here's what you told me in Norfolk. Today we found an interesting thing in our exploits. It was on Gary Bond's, because Gary was at the Norfolk show. It was on Gary Bond's Legrand label, a 12-inch Rudy Webb and the Marquise with a wrapper. I'd never seen it before, and to think of the Legrand label in the 80s was something. It was at a flea market here. But then you stopped and told me, but it was warped.
Hey, that's okay. So am I.
So you and back then you told me you and Gary Tallon have a shared collection of 5,000 45s, 4,000 albums, and 2,000 78s. Have you whittled that down?
Approximate numbers, that's correct. Gary's a much more stable character than I am. He's much more together, and he's built shelves for the records, and I would have just left them all stacked up around my house and playing whenever I felt like it. So he gets custody of them, but we go down. I go down. He's living in Nashville. And, because he's on the road now. But I'll go down and visit in Nashville and stay with him for a few days, and we'll have what we call a record night or a vinyl night. And all of these musicians will come over, and critics, some people like that, and I'll bring over their latest finds, and they'll sit there and everybody will have some wine or some whiskey, and we'll play records for hours and hours, and everybody will ooh and ah over the latest things or say that stinks. And it's really a lot of fun. You have to be a record collector to be into that, but it really gives you use of your records, too. They don't just sit there and collect dust. You really listen to them, and it's just a great thing to do. It's a lot of fun.
And, I mean, I'm sure it gives you source material, and even to this day.
I've covered so many records that, as a matter of fact, Soul Time, the latest album, I was going to do a song I've wanted to do for 30-some years, Weak Spot, by Ruby Johnson on the Volt label. And then we sat down to write, and that was one of the songs we were going to cover. And we just started writing songs, and we found out that we had enough songs of our own. So once again, it didn't get covered. It's probably the third time I've gone into the studio saying, I'm going to do this song, and we haven't done it.
Okay, we're going to, John, we're going to take a break here for some commercials, and we'll be back. I want to talk to you about, when we come back, about your love for Chicago blues. So don't go away on WGN.
Woman, look me in the eye. You've told me your last lie. I'm telling you just what I want to say. Because games are for children, and I'm a full-grown man. It's time I finally made you understand.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN here in Chicago. We're here with John Lyon, Southside Johnny, and the Asbury Jukes, and they're at the House of Blues on August 6th. Right here in downtown Chicago, not far from the studio. Talking about Chicago, John, talk about your love of Chicago blues. I know you're a Paul Butterfield guy, and how did that come into your life?
Well, I guess it's just from listening to my parents' records, and, you know, I really like that kind of music. So when John Hammond came out with his first album, and actually the Stones, too, the first bluesy things, and the Animals, and then Paul Butterfield, it struck me that white people could make good blues, too. And I know that's sort of a crazy statement. But back then, you know, I mean, that's the only music I really wanted to do back then, blues and soul or R&B. I didn't like the Beach Boys. And I wasn't a big fan of the Beatles. But, you know, these guys came along, John Hammond and Paul Butterfield and a bunch of others. And I just thought, yeah, they could do it. I can do it, too, you know. So they were really kind of an inspiration for me. But I grew up, we had a little cheap radio, my brother Tom and I, and we listened to the black stations from Newark, New Jersey, and Philadelphia. And they played a lot of Elmore James and Muddy Waters and Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley, and we loved that stuff. It just before we went to bed, we got an hour's worth of listening, and I just heard so many great songs. And we go try to find those records down in Springwood, which is the black section of Leslie Park. And we would. We'd buy dozens and dozens of records for like 15 cents a piece, the old record. And we just kind of, it's just the music that infused me with enthusiasm to make.
And some of those early Southside Johnny and Asbury Juke records, what was it like to bring people like Ronnie Spector and was Lee Dorsey? I mean, you would bring in these people who at that time were like really forgotten, and you'd put the, yeah, little bit of the spotlight on
them. Well, Steve and I, we had that feeling that, you know, we wanted to, it's like calling the band the Asbury Jukes. We wanted to make sure people understood who we were and where we were coming from. And to bring in somebody like Lee Dorsey, and people go, oh, Lee Dorsey, yeah. Or Ron Spector, or we had the Five Satins and the Coasters on another record. You know, that kind of thing tells people what you are trying to do. Also, you know, you get to use these free resources. Lee is just a ball to sit with, and Ronnie too. And you just have a chance to use these people, to be with these people, and hear all their stories. And we said, the hell with it. If the record company's going to pay for it, of course, I am going to pay for everything. But that's the way it works. You know, we really had a great time with them in the studio. And it really did let people know that we weren't trying to be anything other than a real rhythm blues band.
You told me once there's more than 130 jukes out there, 130 jukes
alumni.
Yeah,
probably a lot more than that by now. No, I'm not hard to work with. I've had this band for 40 years, and people have children and don't want to be on the road all the time. And David Bowie, one of my saxophone players, Diane Ross, who's one of my players once. He's a family member of all the different people that have gone through this band and ended up playing with someone else, Bruce, of course. So, you know, I'm always thrilled when somebody gets a great job offer for somebody who recognizes talent. And I kind of take pride in the fact that so many people have gone through this band and played with other people. But it is a grueling, I mean, you know, it's hard to commit to being on the road 100 and some days a year after all these years. I do it because I love it. They do it because they love it, too. But there are other factors, you know, family enters into it and just being tired of the road. So.
And people don't realize sometimes the economics of like taking out a horn section, it costs a lot to bring a huge entourage on the road, right?
Yes, it's one of the reasons I'll never be a millionaire.
Yeah.
I could have $1 million if I could have a horn section, so I chose a horn section.
John Bon Jovi, wasn't he a juke? I have 1990.
Yes, he got off the road after 2.5 years on the road. He got home, he was home for a month, and it was like Dorothy said, I want to go on the road with the Jukes. She said, fine, go. So he became our rhythm guitar player, and we had to book him into the hotels under an assumed name, so we called him Melvin Velvet.
What'd you call him?
Melvin Velvet. And then we go check in at the hotel, and the woman would go, who's Melvin Velvet? And he'd go, I am.
That's great. I've seen you do the I want to ask how the Fever came to you, because you do such a, you know, that's Bruce's song, but you do such a you kind of made that your own with that blues delivery. How did that come to you, and yeah, tell me how you rearranged that.
Well, we were looking for songs for the first album, and I had seen Bruce like a month before play a college gig, and he did that song. He had just written it, and he did it for the first time. Of course, the crowd loved it. It was great. He had this dramatic delivery. It was very smoky and atmospheric. So Stephen and I were rehearsing the band, and Bruce came and wrote a song pony. And he said, Carter, I want you to do this song on the record. And he started playing the Fever. I said, I just saw you do that. That's a great song. You got to do it on the album. And he goes, no, it doesn't fit on what I'm trying to do. You have it. I went, okay. And that's just the way it was. He loved the song, and he later, of course, did it, but he didn't want to put it on the album. I guess it was probably Born to Run.
Uh-huh.
It would have been perfect, but he gave it to me, and I grabbed it.
Yeah. You know, in August, I'm going to go right after you're here. I'm going to go to Asbury Park. I've been to Jersey a lot, but I've never been to Asbury Park. So what would you tell me? good places to go, especially for me, like record stores and stuff like that. Give me a little tourist guide to Asbury Park.
There is a great album store on Cookman Avenue. I don't know the exact address, but you'll see it. The guy who owns it is a friend of mine, Joe, and he's got a lot of tattoos, and he's a great reggae collector. He goes to Jamaica and buys lots and lots of reggae records. But there's also rock and roll and jazz and, you know, classic albums, originals. So you go in there. That's right on the main street in Asbury Park. And if you want to go see bands, there's The Saint, which is the younger rock and roll band, which is on Main Street. The Stone Ponies always got interesting people. There's the Wonder Bar, which has more of a local act.
Right.
And there's a new place opened up in the hotel, the Esther Hotel, and I can't remember the name of it right now. I've never been there.
That's exactly
it.
That's where I'm staying. Actually, I'm going to stay at the Asbury. That new hotel. It used to be a Salvation Army or something.
Yes, yeah, that's right. And there's a club inside that. And there's also another new club on Cookman Avenue, right down the street from the record store, right down the street. So there's plenty of places to see stuff. And luckily for us, these days, if you come, there are great restaurants. There's a couple of French restaurants. There's a beer garden, which, if you like beer and sausages, is a great hang because it's a lot of people who just, you know, people just talk and sit at communal tables. And Asbury Park is really a great place again. For years and years and years, it was a ghetto and a terrible place and dangerous and depressing. And it's really thriving now. I'm very happy to see it. So when you come, just play it. See all the different things you can see.
I'll drop your name in a lot of places. How much?
Yeah,
how much?
Grab you by the scruff of your neck and throw you out.
How much do you think? A couple more things. We'll wrap it up. How much do you think music had a role in the resurrection of Asbury Park? I mean, because what you guys are doing, it really put it back on the map.
Yes, it had a lot to do with it. You know, through all the corrupt years and the years when nothing was being built and even the roads weren't even taken care of, they all potholed and everything. People still came to the Stone Pony to see different bands, you know, the Ramones and Elvis Costello and all that stuff. And it kept the main Asbury Park alive. And then when the new club started opening and more money started coming in, people were intrigued by moving in because the houses were so cheap. And now you can't get a cheap house in Asbury Park. But the music was one of the draws for people. I remember walking down a boardwalk, taking a walk, and I wasn't playing anything. And these four Korean guys from South Korea came over and said, "Oh, we're from South Korea." And I thought, oh, they recognize me. And I was just walking on the boardwalk next to the Stone Pony. And I'm like, "Will you take a picture with the Stone Pony?" And they didn't know who I was. So I took a picture of him in front of the Stone Pony. And he's a guy from South Korea who had heard of Asbury Park. So it really was a tremendous draw, the music and just the atmosphere of Asbury Park. And now it's even better than it ever has been. It's a little more, I don't want to say sedate, but it's a little more upscale. But it still has great bands and great food. And, you know, there's a pinball palace you can go to, all that stuff.
Soul Time, Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes. It's on Leroy Records, southsidejohnny.com. It's, you know, I bought it at the merch table in St. Charles. What's your, and I just, this wasn't on my list of questions, but I'm thinking about, especially, you've been coming to Chicago a lot more recently, which is good, but what's your favorite cover? Because I'm thinking about, you know, and the songwriter passed away, but you do such a great version of Walk Away, Renee. But what's your favorite couple songs just to cover in concert?
It depends on the night, you know. Oh, geez. Well, Fever is one of them. I guess that's not a cover anymore. But we have a lot of stuff. I'm trying to think of what we actually do cover. Without Love, which is a Aretha Franklin song.
Right.
And NMA is another one. I mean, the thing is that you know if you go into that song, people are going to like it. And then jazz steps up and takes a saxophone, and usually just knocks us all out. So it is a joyous moment when you do those songs. It's not tedious at all. But we do stuff on stage that we haven't even rehearsed. I mean, if I feel like doing a song and I start singing it and just starts playing the keyboards, people will fall in and we'll do the song. I mean, we may butcher it a little bit, but at least we're giving it a shot. And when it works, everybody knows that we were just winning it. And so everybody in the audience and the band shares in this moment where you're making music, you're creating music.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here on Nocturnal Journal, John Lyons. Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes at 8 o'clock, August 6th, Saturday night at House of Blues here in Chicago. Thank you, John Lyons. Safe travels, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
My pleasure. See you out there.